Good. All right, well, welcome. This is the 28th day of October 2015. 2014. Wow, okay, let's try this again. This is October 28th, Tuesday of 2014. And I'm Brian Halstos, and I'm sitting with, maybe we can go around the room, you can introduce yourself.
My name's James Martin. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. And I'm a former student of the University of Dubuque.
I'm Dustin Aker. I'm also from Madison, Wisconsin.
Acres by the... Orchids by the acre?
Like the farming acres, yeah.
Okay.
In real estate.
All right.
My name is Gordon Mussel.
My name is Sharon Bohr.
My name is Garrison Grubb.
My name is Christian Qualchuk.
And so we're here today to hear Mr. Martin's story about his experience at UD and to have all the students ask questions as well. But maybe I'll start us off with kind of a broad question. What brought you to UD in the first place?
What brought me here? I think ostensibly I came here to play sports and to get an education. I was, I came to play football. I happened to be a basketball player in high school and I was a baseball player in high school. So I played all three when I was here. I did intend to get an education, which I did get, but I think that's more than anything else what brought me here. I actually heard of the University of Dubuque because there was a student here. He was a year older. He was a year ahead of me in high school, but we lived across the street from each other, really kind of kitty corner for kind of the formative part of my early childhood. And so I knew a gentleman by the name of Kent Cushenberry. He was going to school here. How he found the University of Dubuque, I have no idea. But the other part of it was the football coach at the time here went to my high school. He was from Racine, Wisconsin, where I'm from, Racine, Wisconsin. And there was a connection there, and there was kind of a push there because his father was kind of at every sporting event. So it was someone else that was kind of pushing me to come to school here.
But it's more football than the other sports that you played when you were here?
Actually, I'm a child of the 50s, and in the 50s, baseball was king. Football was before ESPN, and I really wanted to be a baseball player. But I knew when I came here that I was going to play football. So and that's where my name is in the record books, is in football, not baseball. the baseball part ended fairly abruptly and soon.
Was it an injury, or what ended the baseball?
My arm wasn't strong enough, and I didn't hit well enough to play at a professional level. I mean, that puts it at a succinct end. You can play well up until you get to a certain point, and when you try to move to that next level, they let you know whether or not they think you're good enough or not.
Well, but you played through college. You played when you're
here. I did.
All through college.
I did.
Okay.
I did.
And maybe you just mentioned some in the record books here. What did you play, and how well did you play when you were here?
Well, that's debatable how well I played. We did.
You may brag.
No, not really. There's no bragging. We did not fare very well until my high school quarterback got kicked out of the Air Force Academy and came here, and he was pretty good. And so then we started to win. But I played. I've got a record that's 51 years old. That's still on the books, and the other one will be 50 years when it gets to 2017, and I don't think there's anybody who's close to getting close to it.
Wow, what is that record?
I intercepted 8 passes in 63, 8 in 64, and I have a total of 24. Wow. I don't think anybody's close to the 24. There might be somebody who's been close to the 8, but not the 24.
Hmm. That's pretty awesome.
But anyway.
Were you cornerback or safety?
I was a safety.
That's pretty impressive.
All right, what are questions?
I guess, in general, what was the campus kind of like at that time?
Well, the campus was the quadrangle. And it wasn't until I think I might have been a senior when the two dorms down by the football field, they opened, and we thought that was in the boondocks. There was no way an upperclassman would walk that far from class, from the football field to the quadrangle. It was very small. Actually, this school was smaller than my high school. I had 523 or 24 kids in my high school in my graduating class. We had a three-year high school at that point in time, and there was somewhat over 1,600, 1,700 students. When I came here, we'd be hard-pressed, I think, to get to 650. And that would
really?
Be that would be counting the townies and everybody. So it was quite small. The only thing I think that was helpful, my freshman class had probably 12 African Americans in it, 12 or 13, which far exceeded the 4 that were on campus in the other 3 grades. I think there might have been one senior African American female. There was a junior, an African American female, and there were 2 males, one being Kent Cushenberry, who I came to school with, the other being Dozier Jones, who you've talked about. And then we had about, I better look again, but it's 12 to 15 that were, that was kind of the largest group that the school had had up until then, at least in that history part.
And you entered in what year?
I entered in September, it was really September back then. We didn't start school in August. September of 1963. It was probably a little less than 4 weeks after Dr. Martin Luther King's I Had a Dream speech.
You mentioned Cushenberry, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that told you about University of Dubuque?
Yes, he was here, yes. Okay.
When he was telling you about the school, did he tell you about the environment? Was that like a reason why you came here towards African Americans, or did he kind of just talk about the sports and that was what led you here?
No, that he was going to school here over the summer. Dozier Jones went home, because Dozier was from the Atlanta area. He went home with Kent for the summer. I got to know him. I was looking around thinking, what am I going to do? And decided, well, you know, I'll take a visit. And he was very positive, so I decided, I'll apply and see what happens. And I got here, and it was small, quaint, and I liked it. I'm not sure whether or not I would have fared real well on a large campus, but, you know, I don't have to worry about that anymore. I didn't go to a large school, I went to a small school.
How did the racial demographics here compare to the high school you came from? And when you came here to UD, did you feel like you were a part of the campus, or did you feel like you stuck out as an African American? Do you remember, you know, that first experience on campus?
As I told you before, I probably came here, and my coming is not at all unusual compared to the other people that you're going to call. I came from an integrated high school. I lived in Racine, Wisconsin. And when I say integrated, everybody, I had an argument one night with a lady who thought that Racine Park was 95% African American. Well, we probably had 2% or 3%.
Did we? That's a real discrepancy.
Yeah, there's a real discrepancy. Did we have a few kids on the football team? Always. Did we have a few kids on the basketball team? Yes, and sometimes more started than normal. But this was not unusual for me coming into an integrated situation. What was unusual is that there were many whites in the 60s who had never seen, some of them had never seen, no, and certainly had never gone to school with anyone of color, had never lived in a dorm with anyone, and certainly some had never had roommates. Now, all those things were not unusual for me, not that I had a lot of white roommates, but I played on baseball teams where I was the only African American, and so when we traveled, I naturally had a white roommate. So that wasn't an unusual thing. Although my freshman year here, I had an African American roommate. It was Obi Sadler from Waterloo, Iowa. So that wasn't an issue. So coming here wasn't new to me. I guess I can probably say I'm 69 years old. I have never had an African American teacher. And I've been to the University of Indiana and the University of Wisconsin in addition to here, and not in any class that I've ever had, with the exception, in junior high school, I probably had a substitute teacher, because we did have one in Racine at that time. Racine had no full-time African-American teachers until the period at which I was here in Dubuque, between 63 and then 67, they hired their first teachers, and I went back and was a teacher in the Racine Unified School District from 1967 to 1970.
What grades were you teaching?
I taught physical education, and I had 10, 11, and 12. We had a three-year high school.
In the classroom here, did you ever have any experiences with professors who maybe treated you differently at UD?
I probably can't put my finger on any specific incident. It's not to say that I don't know one person fairly intimately who thinks she had an adverse situation. But I really can't say that anyone treated me differently, negatively. Did I have positive experiences? You bet. But I can't really say that, I got a B in this class and I should have deserved an A, and the only reason why I got a B is because I was African American. I can't lay my finger to one of those.
So just to clarify, there was no instructors on UD at that time that were of any color?
My first year here, no. I don't believe my second year here there were any. We did get an African American instructor, I think, when I was a junior, and he was still here when I was a senior. The guy's name was Marungi. If I was an African student, an African professor was not a African-American, wasn't, American-born. But I had no instructors here who were African-American.
This Professor Marungi, do you remember what he taught?
I want to say he taught philosophy, but I didn't bring a yearbook that would show him in here. I know he's not in this one, because this is my freshman year one, because I thought most of your questions are going to be about my freshman year, but maybe not.
What did you study?
I'm a physical education major. I started out in history,
You changed.
I changed. I won't explain why I changed, but I did change. Changed early on, and have a physical education undergrad degree and a law degree.
You won't explain why you changed?
No, it's all right. we won't go there this year.
So did you feel welcomed when you came to UD the first year?
I did. There was never a point where I didn't feel welcome. As I said, the football coach was from my high school. I had talked with him extensively before. Probably a lot of people thought that there was a lot of favoritism my way since he had gone to my high school. And I still see him. I mean, he's 85 or 86 years old. He moved back to Racine after traveling around, and I still see him. So from that standpoint, I had no adverse effects. John Knox Coit was a philosophy instructor, and he was kind of very interested in athletics. He was a PhD doc, but he dispensed aspirin after all football games like he was a MD doc. but a great gentleman, who at one point I think he became the dean of the college. I'm not sure if that was while I was here or after he left and came back, but just an excellent person who had an interest in me and was such that I even named my son bears his middle name, or my son's middle name is Knox, which I thought was kind of definitive of John Knox Coit.
Did you find like the same kind of welcome in Dubuque, the town as a whole, that you did in UD?
The town was different. We were up here on the hill, and we were kind of in a different world. I always thought Dubuque was 60,000. I'm sure it wasn't back in the 60s. Dubuque had 3 African-American families in town. They lived, I can't remember if it's 9th Street going down. I think it's 9th Street going down. If you went out and took University Avenue and Baird left and went down the hill, when you get down the hill where there's a V in the road, those 3 families lived, there was a big billboard that was up there. Those 3 families lived behind those billboards and some pretty difficult housing, but those were the only 3. So there was no African-American presence here. I had a car after my sophomore year, and for kind of Sunday afternoon giggles, we would look in the paper and see where houses either were for rent, and we would go and take a look at them and see how people would just shudder when you knocked on the door. So it was very difficult, or different. We didn't have too many issues other than, you know, we'd walk downtown and go to the movie theater in the 60s was downtown on Main Street there. You'd come back and you know, you'd have some hooligans who would drive by and yell the N-word at you and stuff as you're walking back up the street. But by the time we got back and got a car, and then these all happened early on when I didn't have a car, because otherwise I would have been in my car. You couldn't find those folks. But that was really the the only issues that I really kind of saw in the town that were distasteful. When I first got here, I didn't know anybody, didn't even know the other freshmen, and I did decide there was a bartender, I needed a haircut, and I realized when the guy made the first move that he had never, ever cut an African-American's hair, and so that was the last time I ever went to a barber. I mean, we finally, once all the students, because the football players, we all got here, we all had to come earlier. Once all the students came, we found a freshman named John Lewis who could cut hair, and so John Lewis cut my hair for the next 4 years when I was in school. I mean, you know, and it's probably the same way here. You find somebody who can cut hair, and that guy's got a business.
Yep. There's a boy in the new dorm. There's a boy that cuts all the boys' hair. They always talk about him.
And I've got a friend that I play golf with every day. In Madison, and that's what he did at Jackson State in Jackson, Mississippi in the 50s. He was the barber. And so every school has one.
So I guess we got a kind of a good idea of what it was like with instructors, but as far as the dorms were there any like kind of conflicts that arose because of color or anything like that?
You know, I don't remember any conflicts in the dorm as it relates to color.
Where did you live? Which dorm?
I lived in Severance, up on the second floor, probably right at this corner, at this end. Like I said, I had an African-American roommate. The only conflict we had is that I was always used to my mom coming into my room and picking my clothes up off the floor and washing them, and the guy I room with was a neat freak, and so, you know, he decided after a couple weeks we have to have a conversation. Well, it turned out that I also learned that if I threw my clothes on the floor when I wanted to wear them again, guess where they were? They were still on the floor. So I kind of changed my habits. It was a part of you know, the time management that you learn in college, and you learn you've got to take care of your own things. If you don't, you know, your mom's not going to come and help you anymore. It's over.
So, were you involved in any organizations here?
I was, not very, when you say organizations, unlike Mr. Stubblefield, who was, you know, class president, he was kind of a civic guy. I was not that, not that inclined, because I wasn't here that often. Every time the football team left town, I left town. The basketball team left town, I left town. The baseball team left town, I left town. So that was mine. I did join a fraternity my freshman year. Was active in that.
Which one?
I was a Phi Omicron.
Okay, I'm an A.
You're an A, okay. They were in business back then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of back in our time, the Phi Omicrons they're all jocks, or primarily jocks.
Yeah.
And that kind of, that's a cyclical thing that changes over and over again. But those are probably the two organizations that I, you know, the two things that I did the most of. I guess I would say this about, you know, whether or not we had any conflict. The one thing that I will allude to, and I wasn't a card player until I came to college, although I did learn very quickly how to play bid whist, and probably most black kids know how to play bid whist, and most white kids don't. And certainly the kids from the South all knew how to play bid whist, and so we did. In the early years, we did eat together, the African American students, and we did go down into the underground area below Peters Commons, and we played cards right after dinner until about 7 o'clock or whenever everybody took off to go study. John Knox Coit did come to us. I remember specifically he came to us and said that people were concerned that one, that all the African-American students ate together, and why was it? Was it whether or not we felt unwelcomed, or we thought we needed to stay in a group? And he wanted to know why we all in the underground all stuck together, because we were all around kind of a central table. There was one table, and we played rise and fly, which means if you win, you stay. If you lose, you're out of here. And if someone, the game kind of, you two may know, that if you take all the tricks, it's called a Boston. And if someone has a hand that they know they're going to take all the tricks, it is, as my friend Dozier Jones taught us how to do it, when you put your cards down, you put them down in such a way that your knuckles hit and everybody knows, here we go. And so we made a lot of noise and people were somewhat concerned about it. So he asked us, why did we, do it? He says, well, we're the only ones that know how to play Bidwist and nobody else has asked us. So we did, because we had a number of kids out of New York who weren't afraid of African Americans and weren't standoffish. And so, said, hey, if they want to play, tell them to come on over. We'll give them a lesson before we start taking their money at night. We didn't play for money down in the student union, but we did play for money in some of our rooms. So, that part of it, we had to kind of explain what the dynamic was. One, we didn't feel ostracized. Two, we ate together because, we wanted to. And three, we played cards because we were only playing Bidwist. Did I know how to play bridge? Yes, because I had played with my friends and played some other card games with guys that I played ball with, but they were playing Bidwist, so I played Bidwist, and that's what we did. But that part of it is the only time that I think anybody ever really asked us about how we were doing socially, and we did well socially. Did African Americans date whites as a rule? No, not much. In the 60s, in 63, Catholics didn't date Protestants. Protestants didn't date Catholics. And that was the way the world was. And blacks didn't date or marry whites. But Loving versus Virginia wasn't until 1967. That was the first time the Supreme Court says it wasn't illegal for blacks to marry whites. So, it was kind of that time change. We were in the kind of the middle of it. So there wasn't much of an issue. Did we go out with whites? Yeah, we did. Nobody ever said anything to us. I have no idea what was said in dorms, about it. But, it happened.
In addition to Bidwist, what were some of the other acts? A Friday night comes and you're looking to go have a good time. What comes to mind?
As a general rule, there wasn't a whole lot of social function going on. We made what is the underground kind of a social part of it. I happen to, what I think, have gone to school during the heyday of Motown every week almost, and we got them later than anybody else. There was a new Supremes hit, Four Tops hit, Impressions hit, and so we kept trying to keep getting the jukebox updated so that we could hear the latest on the jukebox.
Jukebox was in Peter's Common
in the underground down there. That was the jukebox. There was also a black and white television in kind of the what I would call the north. It was kind of a northern room. But for the most part, on Friday nights, people were down in the lower level of Peters Commons. I don't know what time they kind of lowered the lights and people would dance and do things. Other than that, it was really kind of fraternity driven. The fraternity would rent a large room at one of the hotels. Principally, it's not there anymore. It used to be Dodge Street that you come across the Illinois Bridge. That whole area now, which is kind of green space, used to be all commercial. I mean, it was everything commercial. There was a Holiday Inn there, and I remember having a number of those there. We, on occasion, would drive across into Wisconsin because Grant County in Wisconsin was an 18-year-old county where you could drink beer at 18. Iowa was 21. And so we would go over there if we were going to have a party. You have to remember, 1963, if you got caught with any alcohol, you got sent home for the most part.
On your brother otherwise?
Usually they had to catch it. They had to catch the bottle somewhere or whatever it was. And usually you went home. And East Dubuque at that time was kind of a shotgun street where every building was a bar and they had go-go dancers and stuff. And well, if you got caught, if you're underage and got caught there, which was almost seemed like every Saturday night, somebody was running through the dorm saying, so-and-so, got picked up in East Dubuque, we need $50. So they'd go through and get a dollar from like 50 people to go back over to pay their fine to get them out and hope like heck that administration didn't find out. What you didn't want to have happen is the administration have to go over to get you, because if that happened, they're probably gonna say bye-bye to you.
Were there instances of people drinking in the dorms? Or that you can think of?
Oh, let's see, how do you answer that? I have heard that people drank in the dorm. I have heard at this location where Stephens Hall used to be up on the fourth floor, on the fourth floor of Stephens was a dorm. I mean, basically large rooms, a couple people lived in them, and there was never any screens on any of the windows. And I've heard that some of the tile shingles could be lifted and you could set a bottle outside your window in and cover it up with a tile there and you would be okay. That's
all hearsay.
Word
on the street.
That's right. It's all hearsay.
Sounds a bit like your mystery bugle.
That's right. Yep. That's true.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
You talked a bit about John Knox Coit. Were there other professors who really made an impact on your life, or administrators? Was Dr. Couchman or President Couchman present and visible?
Dr. Couchman was very present, very visible. He knew your name. He talked to you in the same way I hope that Dr. Bullock talks to you when he sees you walking on campus. We all knew, and he lived right on the far end of Goldthorpe there, where they've done the addition, and when they did the addition, they knocked down what used to be the president's house. So he was right there. Roger Woods was a religion professor who came over. He was fairly young. Came over, played basketball, intramurals, pickup games with us. Very instrumental, nice man. We had some good professors. We had some people who made you toe the line. Meryl Sandvin was a psychology professor, very good, excellent. I coined the phrase always as I've told it to a number of people. I've been in classes where the professor was so bad he put the student to sleep, and as typical, professor says, "Not, would you wake up so and so who's sitting right who's sleeping?" And of course, Doc Sandman says, "If you put him to sleep, you wake him up." So I guess I would just say I had good professors who knew who I was, who took an interest in me, and I'm so thankful for a couple religion professors who helped me get out of religion classes. that was the first telephone call I made home. "Mom, I need a Bible," because they gave you back then. They told you what your first semester classes were going to be. Everybody had to take Bible 5, which was the Old Testament, first semester. Second semester, everybody had to take the life and teachings of Jesus, which was the New Testament. And we had a couple professors that said if you didn't, who disagreed with the administration on taking roll, but they basically said if you don't come to class, you can't pass the exam, because you got a different exam than everybody else got. So that's how they solve the whether you're going to be in class or not. And everybody knew it. You better be there.
Glad they don't do that now.
What?
Give a different exam?
No, well, a little different day and age. Yeah. And you know. But I'm sure if you had Larry Terrell as your professor in Life and Teachings of Jesus and you didn't show up and he didn't like to take roll, that your father had better been a minister, or you had better been in church 7 days, you know, every week to pass his exam, because he would make it difficult for him.
Was chapel a requirement during the years?
Chapel was a requirement every Friday
for all the students, or just the first year students?
Oh, everyone. Everyone went to chapel Friday, I don't know, about 10:30 in the morning.
And where was it held? At
Westminster.
Westminster
Church. They took roll.
There's the same structure that's up there now, or is the church?
Pretty basically the same structure that was there. And it seated everyone. Okay. Everyone who wasn't cut in chapel. but it was a requirement.
Now I know you said it wasn't that much of a change for you coming here to an integrated school, but as opposed to like a lot of other black students, you think what kind of effect did that have?
I think you're going to talk to Ozell Hudson. Who's talking to Ozell? You are. Okay. You've got Dozier Jones. Mm-hmm. Whoever gets Shastina Mitchell.
I have Alice
Stubblefield.
It's going to be the same. It's going to be the same for her too. Every kid from the South will never have had a white teacher. Every kid from the South probably will never had gone to a school with any white students. So for them, it's going to be completely different. I think Ozell will tell you he probably never had any meaningful contact with anyone who was white before he came here. And I think you'll find for those kids who came from the South, they didn't have a choice as to where they came to school. They were told where they were going to go to school. I think you'll find that to be true. And so their experience is going to be completely different. I think you'll find the kids that came out of Georgia rode in the back of the bus all the way here because they couldn't ride in the front of the bus. It'll be be interesting, because I don't remember having a conversation with them of where they ate when the buses stopped. In 63, very difficult. 63, James Meredith integrated the University of Mississippi, and they did that with federal troops. And I mean, I stayed on campus a long time. I'm not even sure. I really don't remember whether or not he ever graduated. He may have stayed the whole time. When they integrated University of Alabama, they did it the same way. I don't believe Charlene Hunter Gault, who's on PBR, public radio, public television, I don't think she ever finished at Alabama. I think she said, "This, I can't do this anymore," and left. And I want to think, there was a gentleman who integrated Alabama with her that lived in Madison for decades. I can't think of his name right off the top of my head. He just passed away 2 years ago. I don't think he stayed at Alabama either, because it was such a hostile environment. So 63 was not it was a good year in that they were making some strides at integrating those schools, but it wasn't a thing where an African American could go to any college in the South. I mean, I saw an article the other day. I didn't get a chance to read it. George Wallace said, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. Not a black kid on any of their football teams in 63, nowhere close. And what did I see the other day? Mississippi State, 82% of the football players are African American. And University of Mississippi, 78%. Times have changed. The question is, you know, will those young men, even though they're rooting for them on a Saturday afternoon, will they be taken in and be recognized as having gone to school there in the years to come? I certainly hope so, because they're making tons of money for those schools right now. Tons of money.
You just mentioned Governor Wallace, and it just reminded me of something I learned recently, and I'm blanking on the governor's name now, but he's a Southern governor who was invited to come to Dubuque in the early 60s. And
Ross Barnett.
There he is, Ross Barnett. Yes, governor of Mississippi.
Right. You were ready.
No, it just happens to be in this yearbook, and my friend Bill Stubblefield sent me, I didn't have a copy of it, he sent me a copy of it along with the names of all the students, so it's in the 64 deal. And
do you remember this occurring and what the response was?
You know, I do and I don't. I can say if I was in town, I didn't miss a convocation. They call these convocations. And so we had to be there. They took roll at them, and I didn't. If they took roll, I was there.
Gym?
That's McCormick Gym, right. And I mean, here's a picket here by a kid named Howard Norris. He was a freshman when I was a freshman. It's got to be when I was a sophomore, not a freshman, because Howard has a file jacket on, and Howard only stayed 2 years. So it had to be in the spring of 65 that Barnett was here. And I mean, they say here is a student body listening to Russ Barnett, but I don't see me in that crowd. Now, I could be in a different section where he's at, but I don't think that that's really the case, because this was in McCormick Gym, and these kids look like they're sitting around tables, and there would have been no tables for them to sit around. I would bet almost that might be a Muhammad Ali fight that was on TV that everybody's around listening to, but I don't know what it is. But yes, he was here.
I wonder what the circumstances and why Dr. Couchman, because presumably he had behind his invitation, would invite a pro-segregationist.
I would imagine probably either from the town or some of the what they call board of directors, what we now call board of trustees, probably said we should bring an alternate view, because we did have a number of convocations where we had pro-integrationists who came to speak, and that happened quite frequently because that was the topic of the day. So I assume somebody said we probably should bring an opposing view, and certainly he was an opposing view.
What was the reception like for a lot of those convocations?
They were good and respectful. From my perspective, the ones where they had, I'm drawing a blank. I'll come up with a name here real quick. William Sloan Coffin, who was a freedom writer. He was a speaker, was a Presbyterian minister, and had marched at Selma, came to speak. There were a number of others who came to speak, because it was kind of the topic of the day. And certainly, I was a freshman when Martin Luther King, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And with him being assassinated, when LBJ took over, LBJ was a Southern white who had kind of a remarkable transformation that the man had made. Unlike the parties today, the segregationalists in the 60s were all Southerners, and they were Democrats. They were Dixiecrats, but they were it was a meld, and certainly when John F. Kennedy came in, and John F. Kennedy kind of took the party a little further to the left on integration. It was a tough mix, but after the assassination of Kennedy, you had LBJ as president, and he lasted, I think, probably right until 68. But in the run-up to the 68 election, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and then later in 68, I think Martin Luther King was assassinated. But as a lead-up following John F. Kennedy's assassination, he shepherded through the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which was kind of an unbelievable thing for a Southern Democrat to do, because they were, as a block, they were segregationists, and I assume they were they were Southern Democrats because Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, and they were still wanting slavery. And then when Nixon came in, he took the Southern Democrats, took them to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party, which had been the more liberal party, became the staunch conservative party. And so we kind of had a flip. And so today, when when people say, and with my political statement here, when people say that the Republicans are the ones that freed the slaves, it was a different Republican Party than it is today. It wasn't the Conservative Party, it was the Liberal Party at that point.
When you're seeing them, you come at a time right after the March on Washington, and you're aware of these events that are taking place, and you have people like the senator from Mississippi and others who are anti. Did you feel, as a student, did you feel like you're kind of watching this from a distance and this is removed from your reality, or did you feel like you were empowered to take action and this is a part of your experience and you're connected to what's happening elsewhere in the country? Or what was your perspective on these historic changes?
Well, I certainly knew the history of what was going on. Was I an active participant in civil rights? No. Should I have been? Probably yes. But from my vantage point in Racine, Wisconsin, I didn't see the reality of the situation. It almost looked like what you were seeing on TV was somewhat not a part of your reality. It's almost the same thing as what we see in Ferguson, Missouri right now is not a part of our reality, but it certainly affects what one does. I'm married to a white lady. We travel unrestricted. I know we're going to Florida next month, and I'm half almost, and we lived in Florida for about 13 months in 2001 and 2002. I'm almost saying I'm not going to drive in the South at night anymore for a couple of reasons. One, all the southern states have concealed carry laws. So no matter whether you get picked up for speeding or running a red light, if it happens at night, the officer's going to walk to your car with their hand on the gun or the gun drawn, because they're assuming whoever's inside's got a gun just like they have. It's the sad commentary on America today. When I was growing up, we were always told, if you get stopped, get out of the car, put your hands up to make sure that he knows or she knows that you don't have a weapon. Well, today, they want you to stay in the car. And what happens is what happened to my brother in about 1965, driving my car. I had a Volkswagen Bug. My brother is 5'5". He got pulled over. He was going to get out of the car. And in old Volkswagen, the only way, and he had to have the seat all the way up to the, as close up as it could be. And to get out of the car, he had to reach down to pull the latch to slide the seat back so he could get out the door. Well, when he did that, the cop had the gun on him. And it's like, wait a minute, you're pulling a gun on me. I don't have any, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything. But we're in that dynamic right now where, if you're African American, you have to be very careful, because a traffic stop could be a death sentence. And all they have to say is, I thought he had a gun, and they're gonna walk. But it's America. So I don't know what to tell you as to what you're supposed to do when you get pulled over, because I really don't know anymore.
Did you meet your wife here at University of Dubuque?
I did not. I met my first wife here. I've been divorced once. I met my first wife here, yes.
Okay. Was she another African-American student?
She was, yeah.
In your class?
No, she is 2 years younger. And she came out in New York.
Okay. You mentioned a little before, you said generally the African-American students dated other African-American students, or students of color.
Mm-hmm.
Were there times when that changed? That was something that
really not during the period of time that I was here. over the period of time that I was here, I don't think that changed at all. I went out with three young ladies here, and they were all African Americans. Two happened to be from New York, and one happened to be from Tennessee.
So, during that time when all the Southern desegregation and integration, was the reaction that they had in the South, was that similar to the reaction that it was up here in the North, or was it completely opposite?
It's hard to really tell you. I mean, I had a young lady when I was a freshman walk up to me, a white young lady walk up. She wanted to rub my skin. We wanted, as to whether or not is it going to rub off or what, or can I feel it? Just to feel and feel what your skin feels like. In retrospect, I would look and say that some of the issues that were prevalent in the South were clearly prevalent in the North. I think you're going to find for Bill Stubblefield, he went to Catholic grade schools, and so probably he went to school with whites in Chicago. I don't believe his high school on the far south side of Chicago had, there might have been some white students that go there, but boy, it's 95th Street. Not many, but I'm sure he had white teachers in the Chicago school system there. Certainly, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is probably one of the most segregated communities in the country. I mean, probably was in the 2000s before some of those schools. Inner city schools had any whites that were in them at all. Most of them were all black. So you had some of the same kind of dynamic. I guess going around Iowa, I mean, there were plenty of places where people would look at you strange. As a freshman, I played basketball. We went to Mount Pleasant, Iowa, where Iowa Wesleyan University is, or college was. We had played at William Penn that night, and we were gonna stay there. And we went to this hotel. They had a black hitching boy outside. And I told the basketball coach, it was Chet Buckley, I'm not staying in this hotel. And he said, Jim, you have to. We don't have any other place to stay, and we've already paid for your room, so you've got to stay there. And I said, I'm not staying there with this black kitchen boy out front. I just thought that was very derogatory. He finally talked me into staying there. The next morning, I didn't eat breakfast. I took my breakfast money, went down to the hardware store, bought a can of spray paint, and he participated, because when we left the hotel to go play our game, all the basketball players, and they were all white except me, stood around the hitching post, and I painted it white. We got on the bus and I drove out. Now, the next couple of years that I went back there, I was wondering whether or not, some police officer was going to walk up to me and say, "Hey, we heard you did that," but it's never happened. So, and I haven't been back there since 1967. I don't think.
Probably a good choice.
Well, there weren't very many places. In some places early on, you would hear the N-word at games, and certainly I have an experience certainly hearing it in basketball games. In 63, as far as I know, there were two black students at Central College, and one I had played against in high school, so I knew him, so I talked to him.
There were probably a handful, when I say a handful, maybe two handful, maybe 8 to 10 kids that went to Upper Iowa University, which is worse. I mean, that's in Fayette, Iowa. Very few at Wartburg. I know that was actually Wartburg. It was where I first heard about going to school in Iowa, because a guy tried to recruit me to go to Wartburg. One of my high school classmates went there, and I came here. Luther, maybe one. William Penn had a few, and primarily off the East Coast. Buena Vista. I don't remember a black kid there. I do remember a Puerto Rican kid who was a really good baseball player. Matter of fact, he played for the Twins.
Who was his name?
I don't remember now. It's been a long time.
It wasn't Zoilo Versalles.
No, it wasn't Zoilo Versalles. No, it wasn't.
It's a few years earlier.
And a kid that I played with that went to Central, played for the Yankees, with a kid named Jerry Kenney. But he played during the period when the Yankees were really bad in the 70s. They had lost their luster. Where else?
Did you mention Loras?
We did not play Loras in any sport when I was in school. Loras didn't have a football team in the 60s, and we did not ever play them in basketball or anything. There was kind of bad blood between the two schools, and they didn't play each other. I don't know whether or not we probably at a triangle or another meet probably did, like in wrestling or something like that, end up having to wrestle against somebody from Loras. But as a general rule, we did not play Loras at all.
Did you have any interactions with Loras students?
Yes. Well, back in the 60s, Loras was all men. And wherever there's an all-men school, there's an all-women school. All-women school. That was Clark. I never remember there being more than one black female at Clark. There were a number of black males at Loras. They typically came over here and tried to date the black females at UD. They had hours, the same as our women had hours. Our women had, on weekdays, had to be in Aitchison Hall by 10 o'clock lockdown. They had 10 o'clock lockdown. On weekends, I think you had to be 11 or 12 o'clock, and you could get a pass to 1 o'clock every now and then. The interaction is usually, those guys stayed on our campus so late with their girlfriends, if they found one, that they couldn't get back to school on time, and so they were always trying to get me to give them a ride back so that they could make ours. The interesting thing is, if you've seen Brian Gumbel on ESPN,
yeah,
he was at Loras in 64 to probably 64 to 68.
Wow.
I don't know him, and so I just kind of wonder whether or not he ever got in my car. I mean, he was certainly, if he did, he was certainly a lot smaller, as we all are, and
stole
it didn't look like it. No, he didn't steal my girlfriend. The girlfriends usually kick me to the curb, but it usually wasn't for anybody else other than just me being selfish. So I can't say that that ever happened. Or at least I won't admit that. Other questions?
We're about to the end here. Is okay. there anything that you'd wanted to say that hasn't been asked? Or I guess, is there anything else that's burning?
Oh, so John would be mad if we didn't ask the question.
Oh, I'm not sure.
What is your favorite McCormick memory in the gym?
Well, God, you got good or bad memories.
Either or.
When I was, well, let's see this way. We didn't play basketball in McCormick when I was here until I was a senior. And that was when they kicked out the back wall and turned the court so it looks the way it is today. So it was a really small court sideways. So we practiced there, we never played there. We usually played at senior high school, and we have played out at West Dubuque High School, but we didn't play basketball in there until senior. Favorite memories, oh God. I got some nightmares in there.
Those were too.
Pledge night?
Yeah, well, we were there on pledge night, yeah. Be hard pressed. I mean, there's some things that happened. I can remember missing the back end of a 1-1 and we end up losing a basketball game. I can remember a kid elbowing me when I was off to the side and breaking my glasses, hit me across the face, and you know, the next time he came, he drove down the middle. I just threw a punch that I should have gotten kicked out of the game for. But you know, good thing that happened. Hey, the good thing has happened. There was a pool down there, and I had to pass the swimming class to get out of my major. And hey. Making it from one wind to the other was a good day that day, because I'm not a strong swimmer.
Good memories, you survived. Yeah.
That's about it. I don't really remember because it is not anything like it used to be. I mean it. That gym now turned so that it's 94 feet east to west is kind of a really a new configuration. It wasn't the same as what it was there. And today you guys have some facilities that are absolutely outstanding. Any other questions? I guess what I would encourage those that are going to talk to some of the kids in the South, and you probably have read Paul Clayton's story of how he got here. My story, as I said before, it's unremarkable. Theirs, I think, is remarkable because they really had a change. They came here. First time they ever saw snow. First time they ever had. We were in a classroom with whites. The first time they ever had a white teacher. And their travel. I came 3 hours, 180 miles. They came a lifetime. I mean, they came. Thomasville, Georgia is almost in Florida. And to ride all the way up here, not knowing where they were coming to, was different because none of them had ever been here before until they got here just before the first day of class. And they'll probably tell you, Reverend Johnson told them, they're going to school at the University of Dubuque. And their parents let them go, which is, I think, somewhat remarkable. That it happened that way, but that's how it happened.
Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Yes, thank you very much.
That's all I know.